From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, winds change for the Michigan GOP leader who called the state's top three elected officials witches.
It's unclear, you know, what triggered Ron Weiser's mind to say, I need to issue a more explicit statement walking back these comments. It's unclear at this moment.
Also, marking time and the indelible changes that we've all weathered through the pandemic.
Oh my goodness, it just feels like, how will we ever be the same people we were in 2019?
And we meet some of the women who kept Michigan's lighthouses.
Right from the very beginning, women earned as much as men did in that same role. And I think that is because the service did not expect women to last in the job. So they figured, you know, let's not create a whole new category of pay.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we'll speak with two Michigan writers about surviving the pandemic.
I've been changed by what I think I should save, how I should conserve, how I should spend time. What is family and what brings you joy, simple joy?
That's coming up later in the show. But first, the chairman of Michigan's Republican Party is in some hot water. Ron Weiser was caught on video last week at a meeting of the North Oakland Republican Club calling Michigan's governor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general, all women, the three witches.
Our job now is to soften up those three witches and make sure that when we have good candidates to run against them, that they are ready for the burning at the stake. So
he also made a passing reference that assassination might be the only way to remove Republicans Fred Upton and Peter Meyer from Congress in favor of more conservative options. Since then, Weiser has issued an apology. First, he said his comments were taken out of context. As pressure mounted, he issued a statement that read in part, "I apologize to those I offended for the flippant analogy about three women who are elected officials and for the offhand comments about two other leaders. I have never advocated for violence and never will." With us today is the reporter who broke this story in the first place, Craig Mauger, political reporter for the Detroit News. Hey, Craig.
Hey, thank you for having me.
In this day and age, an apology, an actual apology from a public figure like Ron Weiser seems to be like a big deal. He personally has not been known to apologize for controversy, including his comments about the January 6th insurrection in Washington, D.C., nor for his handling of some GOP candidates that was called into question by his predecessor at the party. I have to say, too, like just a straight-faced apology is something of a rarity in political circles. Does this strike you as a big deal?
Yeah, I think the apology was a big deal, and I think it was surprising. I mean, on Friday when this news was breaking, a lot of members of the Republican Party were defending Ron Weiser's comments and somewhat aggressively defending them. Michonne Maddock, who is his co-chair at the state Republican Party, had tweeted that people raising concerns about these comments were snowflakes at one point. And as you stated, Ron had tweeted that he had been taken out of context. So to go from alleging that, you know, this is something being brought up by snowflakes and the comments are taken out of context to apologizing the following day, that is surprising.
Can you remind us who Ron Weiser is and who he was before he became a figure in politics?
Yeah, I mean, Ron Weiser is an individual who has been involved in Michigan politics for decades. This is his third tenure as the state Republican Party chair. He is also a member of the University of Michigan Board of Regents. That's a detail that has become quite important in recent weeks. And he's an extremely wealthy businessman. He founded a real estate business, and he is a large political donor on top of his personal involvement as a political figure.
We should take a moment to note that the University of Michigan does hold the license for Michigan Radio. Ron Weiser travels in circles with other wealthy people. Do you think it's possible, Craig, that he got pressure from some moneyed interests within the party, specifically who might be supporters of people like Fred Upton and Peter Meyer?
You know, at this hour, I do not know the answer to that question, and I would hate to speculate. I mean, Ron himself is a very large donor to the state Republican Party. You know, if there was pressure, I don't know how successful that angle would be. I do know a lot of Democrats, including Attorney General Dana Nessel, has floated the idea that the pressure has come from the University of Michigan. I mean, Ron Weiser is a major supporter of the University of Michigan. He is on the Board of Regents. And the theory is that officials within the university had pressured him to more directly refute the comments that he made, more directly take them on. It's unclear, you know, what triggered Ron Weiser's mind to say, I need to issue a more explicit statement walking back these comments. It's unclear at this moment.
You used to follow campaign contributions pretty closely with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Is the money that the party relies on, does that come from businesses or political groups that are center-leaning, perhaps groups that wouldn't take very kindly to the things that Ron Weiser said?
As a matter of fact, in this state, a lot of the money that the state political parties raise is from donors that don't have to be disclosed. So a lot of the money from corporations that do flow into the Republican and Democratic parties go to administrative accounts that are never disclosed. So that is potentially something that could be happening, as you raise in your question. There are donors who give to both parties. So from that angle, maybe they are considered centrist in terms of they write checks to both the Democrats and the Republicans, and they might not want their name associated with these type of attacks. That's possible. But at the same time, there are dozens of ways for a donor in Michigan to get a check to someone anonymously so that it can never be tracked. And if you want to avoid the kind of public pushback that these type of comments could bring upon your corporation or political organization, giving money secretly is a quick way to avoid any type of risk.
Have we heard from any other members of the party, say, for example, Fred Upton or Peter Meyer, about what Weiser had to say?
That's possibly one of the more fascinating angles of this in the days, you know, now we are 3 days away from this, is that Fred Upton and Peter Meyer, who have been outspoken and have called out, former Republican President Donald Trump at various times, they have been quiet on this. They have declined to comment through spokespeople about what they think of these comments, whether or not down the road they will make public comments and maybe voice support for Ron Weiser or voice criticism of him. We don't know. But at this point, they've both declined to comment, which I would not have expected because of how outspoken they've been on other issues.
As we've said several times now, Ron Weiser is on the Board of Regents for the U of M and closely affiliated with the school. There was a terse statement from the university's president, Mark Schlissel. Some faculty and staff have called on Weiser to resign. This also seems out of the ordinary for a university administrator and officials to issue statements. Does that strike you as well?
Yeah, I think it is out of the ordinary. It is also somewhat out of the ordinary for other members of the Board of Regents to publicly call out one of their colleagues. That is not something that happens that often. Usually those groups are pretty close-knit, and they try to, you know, levy their criticism quietly. And we've had members of the Board of Regents speaking out quite publicly in the last few days against Ron Weiser. So he is facing a level of public pressure that I don't recall him facing previously, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon.
Right. So, Craig, from a political perspective, it was interesting within the context of that video from the North Oakland Republican Club. Members were far more interested in skewering Fred Upton and Peter Meyer within their own party rather than going after Democrats like Gretchen Whitmer and Dana Nessel and Jocelyn Benson. Meanwhile, in the video, you can tell that Weiser is trying to focus attention on those Democrats. Is this any kind of microcosm of what's happening across the state in the GOP right now?
Totally. I mean, this is the dynamic that is at play in local Republican organizations across the state. And anyone who is involved in Republican politics closely will speak to you about this. I mean, this is what's happening. And if people are confused about what's going on inside the Republican Party, watch the video right now and it will explain to you. There's an immense amount of frustration among those in the grassroots of the party, the people that really, you know, show up to events and keep the party moving in some ways. There's an immense amount of frustration about the November election, and they feel that Republicans didn't do enough to protest how the election was administered and what happened with the results. I mean, that's at the same time, there is no proof of any sort of wrongdoing or election fraud in Michigan's election. But a lot of people in the Republican Party are not letting go of this. And they seem to be, at least some of them, more focused on holding other Republicans accountable for what they did than going after Democrats. And that's the push and pull that's at play here. You have people like Ron Weiser saying, hey, we need to unify to take on Gretchen Whitmer, Dana Nessel, and Jocelyn Benson. And then you have other Republicans within the party saying, no, we can't get to that point yet. We need to talk about Fred Upton and Peter Meyer. And this is that the dynamic that's at play. And it's the dynamic that makes the job of Ron Weiser being chairman of the state party very difficult. And it makes individuals who are considering running against Gretchen Whitmer, Dana Nessel, or Jocelyn Benson probably think twice and consider, you know, do I want to throw myself into this battle that is playing out? And it's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch in the next couple of months.
I mean, is that a danger that extends to Ron Weiser? Could he have just said, look, folks, I know Upton and Meyer are not your kind of Republican, but without them, we are much more likely to lose those districts to Democrats next election?
Yeah, I mean, and there in the extended version of the video, the executive director of the Republican Party spoke after Ron Weiser, and he made that exact point. He told the crowd, he said, if we want to grow our party, if we want to grow by addition, trying to reach out to voters in the middle, we need to focus on Democrats instead of other Republicans. He said that expressly, and the crowd seemed somewhat receptive to it, but there were definitely people who were still more focused on the criticism of Upton and Meyer. And again, this is the North Oakland Republican Club, Oakland County. Peter Meyer and Fred Upton do not represent Oakland County. They're both from West Michigan.
On the other side of the state, yeah.
Yeah, but the focus of this organization is on them. And it's going to be very tricky for these Republican leaders to try to figure out how to maneuver around this current frustration.
Well, Craig Mauger, thank you very much for talking with us about all of this. Craig Mauger is a political reporter with the Detroit News. We really appreciate your time, Craig.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you.
And once again, just disclosure that the University of Michigan holds Michigan Radio's license. Up next, the lives of lighthouse keepers in Michigan, and a very specific group of them, that's women involved in the profession over the years.
Generally speaking, the Lighthouse Service thought that widows could probably take that job on because they had probably been assisting their husbands all along, whether they were paid or not.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When you picture a historic lighthouse keeper on the shores of Michigan lakes, who do you see? Is it a stoic, bearded man standing atop a lonely tower, kind of like Willem Dafoe in that super creepy movie, gazing solemnly across the vast and treacherous waters, one eye on the horizon? It's true, there are some rugged male lighthouse caretakers in our nation and in the state's past, but Michigan, which is said to be home to more lighthouses than any other state in America, also has a rich history of women lighthouse keepers. For a long time, their stories weren't really in the spotlight. But in recent years, they've been brought into deeper focus. As Women's History Month comes to a close, we're checking in with Patricia Major. She's author of the book, Ladies of the Lights, Michigan Women in the U.S. Lighthouse Service. Patricia, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So what first drew you to the history of women in this line of work? Was there one story that initially got your attention?
Well, I'm a museum professional, and I was actually in a position of being the assistant director at Michigan's Women's History Museum in Lansing. And one of my tasks there was to develop exhibits about famous women. And although we did rely on the women in our files as the home of the Hall of Fame, I personally had an interest in lighthouses because I grew up in a lighthouse town. And I read an article in Michigan History Magazine about a lighthouse keeper, and she was female. And I thought, wow, I didn't know there were any, you know, female lighthouse keepers. And in the course of reading the article, I discovered there were more than 50.
Well, where exactly in the state of Michigan can we say that women lighthouse keepers worked?
They worked on Lakes Michigan, Huron, and Superior, and in the Detroit River. They were pretty evenly dispersed and served for a total of 105 years. And when I say they were keepers, they were either assistant keepers, generally to their husband, or they were principal keepers. So about half and half.
Wow. How did women get into this line of work? I mean, it was at a time when, shall we say, the professional options for women were somewhat limited.
Yes, and they were very limited in the federal government, which has always been the boss of lighthouse keepers. The first female lighthouse keeper in Michigan, Catherine Shook, started her job in 1849. And she came into that job, as many women did. She succeeded her deceased husband, who died while in service. And so I, you know, generally speaking, the lighthouse service thought that widows could probably take that job on because they had probably been assisting their husbands all along, whether they were paid or not. I don't think the lighthouse service thought that this was going to be a permanent solution. And that is indicated by things like they never gave women a uniform. Women just wore their street clothes. And they didn't really provide for succession to you know, multiple jobs. They served where they served, you know, at the pleasure of the federal government, and they served well, often besting the men in terms of their performance and their demeanor.
Wow. Historically, what kinds of tasks does a lighthouse keeper have to do? I mean, we know that there's probably a lot of just being there and yeah, enduring all kinds of weather. But what are some of the maintenance parts of the job?
Well, the primary job is to keep the lamps lit, obviously, inside the lighthouses. And they were required to check on those every 4 hours through the evening. So they lit them at dusk and you know, extinguished them at dawn. If weather was bad, they were required to be there a lot more. In fact, many would just stay up the whole night so that the lamps wouldn't blow out. And so that, you know, alone is a bit of a challenge. But there was a lot of cleaning and a lot of maintenance of machinery at a lighthouse. You know, most lighthouses had foghorns, and so they required some adjustment and repair from time to time. There were lots of caustic chemicals that lighthouse keepers came in contact with, and the women were no exception. You know, they had to carry oil up the steps to the lighthouse lantern room, and that's not an easy task either. Oil's much heavier than water. You know, just keeping the light station, which is to say all the buildings there, in working order and clean and painted. And the lighthouse service would visit periodically to make sure that all of their regulations were being followed and gave them the white glove treatment.
You know, it hadn't occurred to me that this would be such a job adaptable to night owls, that they would have to just stay awake and monitor the lights that much. That's kind of a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And many lighthouse families, you know, it was entire families that would inhabit the lighthouse. And, you know, the kids obviously shared in the work and, you know, the husband and wife, depending upon who held what role. But there were a number of lighthouses where women served, you know, as the principal keeper, perhaps managing another woman or a man. And they really had sole responsibility in those cases.
Yeah. Were there any unique circumstances or challenges that you think women faced in this kind of job?
Well, the lighthouse service was very aware and concerned for the safety of women in this job. So they did not allow women to serve on light ships, which are actually, as it sounds like, a lighthouse on a ship that is moored at a particularly treacherous spot in the lakes. They were not allowed to serve there because that would be a crew of four or five men. so that was, you know, obviously a concern there that wouldn't be very safe. They were also not allowed to serve at isolated lights on islands for the same reason. And yet, you know, in some cases, all the safety precautions in the world didn't help some of the women. One woman died, Mary Terry of Escanaba. She died at her lighthouse in a fire. And it's thought that there might have been some a crime committed before the fire was started. Either she was robbed or raped. They don't know. It was never a conclusion drawn. But so she died a fiery death, unfortunately. And you know, there were cases where women lost children to disease or whatever, and they would be at this remote, relatively remote posting, and you just couldn't get to a doctor quick enough. So that, you know, that was a tragic thing that some women buried children out at lighthouses as well. One lighthouse keeper's daughter in the Garrity family, which served in the Alpena area at the Presqu'île lighthouses, she was assaulted by one of the assistant lighthouse keepers that was reporting to her father. And he, in the father in his logbook for the day, actually used the word rape. And he was brought to justice and obviously kicked out of the lighthouse service. But that didn't deter this young woman whose name was Anna. And she later became a lighthouse keeper on her own.
That's amazing. Well, clearly this work had its dangers, and clearly it could be very physically rigorous, in addition to just dealing with the elemental loneliness that's part of it. Was the pay equitable for women who became lighthouse keepers?
Yes, it was, surprisingly. Right from the very beginning, women earned as much as men did in that same role. And I think that is because the service did not expect women to last in the job. So they figured, you know, let's not create a whole new category of pay. Although no one grew rich being a lighthouse keeper. The last female lighthouse keeper, who ended her term in 1954, earned $1,000 a year.
You know, my brain is still kind of stuck on what you said about families serving at lighthouses and the idea of taking care of families in such a solitary situation. That sounds very challenging.
Yes, and there are a number of books actually written by children who grew up in lighthouses. They call them beacon brats. I think the children actually enjoyed it more than the parents did, you know, because they pretty much had free range of an island or a big patch of land on which the lighthouse sat on the mainland. And, you know, in nature and in the water, and in some ways it was a very romantic way to live.
Can we assume these kids were homeschooled?
Yes. And in fact, the lighthouse service did something to help out with that. When they would be on their inspection tours, they would actually drop off a box of books and newspapers and magazines of the day. And that was really what the parents then used to educate their children. So there was that way of being schooled. But a number of the lighthouses that women served at were on the mainland, and some were actually quite close to their communities. For instance, in Marquette, the lighthouse is in the city of Marquette. So those children could obviously go to school, you know, right from their doorstep. And at some of the lighthouses in the Detroit River, the parents would just simply put their kids in a boat and sail them over to Wyandotte or one of the close communities, and they'd get educated there.
Patricia, every line of work has its heroes, or I guess in this case, heroines. Were there any women that you ran across in your research that you think really stand out among the women who were in the lighthouse service?
Well, I, of course, first think of the sort of the rock star of Michigan female lighthouse keepers. Her name was Elizabeth Van Riper Williams, and she served at two lighthouses, one on Beaver Island and one at called Little Traverse Light near Harbor Springs. And she served for a total of 41 years, which is amazing because she was 30 when she started the job. You know, she was so beloved by her community, and although she didn't, to say, physically save anyone in all the time that she served up there, she really became a touch point for women in that area. She'd lost her husband, which is he was actually the keeper. She lost her husband in his efforts to save someone in a shipwreck, so she became the keeper in his place. But after a while, she decided she wanted to be on the mainland, and she applied for this new lighthouse that was being built in Harbor Springs. And it was very rare that any keeper would get a new lighthouse. So you had to have just exemplary record to qualify for that. And she did. She just in terms of longevity, she also wrote a book, an autobiography of her life. And she's been mentioned in a number of national books as well. So she's sort of the icon in terms of Michigan women. There was a woman, the last woman who served, Frances Worry Marshall. She didn't serve at a light that had a lot of shipping traffic. It was more of a West Coast, Lake Michigan, beach town area. And so she wasn't really required to do anything to help with shipwrecks along that area. But she was an extremely strong swimmer, and she saved many lives. When people would come to visit the lake and maybe not be aware of the dangerous riptides that we have in Lake Michigan, and would find themselves just drawn out, into the lake. And, many times she would just, drop everything she was doing and race down the beach and jump in and swim out and save these people. So, that was sort of her second calling besides being the keeper, was being the lifesaver.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me that in addition to just keeping the lighthouse and keeping the light burning, that lighthouse keepers might be expected to serve as lifeguards during shipwrecks. It sounds like that was sort of expected.
Yeah, and to a point, that was a very serious responsibility the keepers had. Later, when the lighthouse service developed the life-saving division, you would often find those two stations, the lighthouse keeper and the lighthouse or the lights lifesavers, built next to each other, and at some major areas where there were treacherous waters, that was a common thing. But that wasn't true at every lighthouse, so all of those keepers had to be aware and awake and prepared if the time should come to save someone.
Right. People have such romantic notions about lighthouses, and some have a lot of legend attached to them or ghost stories. How do you think the fact of women's work in lighthouse keeping, how does that enrich our understanding of lighthouses as cultural symbols?
Well, I think it, as you described the typical image of a lighthouse keeper in your introduction, I think it kind of shows that there were many faces to that position. And, they were approached in different ways by the men and the women. And I think the women really felt it was almost a motherly, maternal responsibility, their boys out on the lakes. Whereas I think the men probably took their job as, almost in a military way, or they viewed it almost, protecting the lives and that sort of thing. And so I think there's, it almost humanizes, the image we have of the typical lighthouse keeper. But I think, too, it shows that it wasn't just a solitary figure. When women were assisting their husbands, they were also, bringing up this family. I mean, most families in the lighthouse service had 5, 6, 7 kids. And it was much like today, women balancing work with their
and family
life.
Yeah. Is there a short answer for why these stories of their work have sort of fallen out of the common parlance? Why we don't hear about their stories very often?
And just in general, women's history is a bit of a struggle to gather and write about. I certainly found that in, as I developed this book out of the exhibit for the Women's Museum, of the 50 plus women who served, I was only able to dig up significant detail of about 15 of those women, with some exception in terms of a few newspaper articles. When something particularly interesting happened at a local lighthouse, I remember they reported on the woman who, Sarah Lane, who was the keeper at Old Mission Point, and the fact that she entertained 1,000 visitors a year.
Oh my gosh.
And mentioned the fact that she had, her husband was an invalid, and she had been keeping the light for him in his name for almost 10 years. So I think there's just, you know, in general, not just in this field and not just in Michigan, but there's kind of a dearth of records about women's contributions. And, you know, I hope my book served to fill in a little bit of that, you know, fill in some gaps and maybe inspire others.
Patricia, do you think you could have done this work?
No. No, I do not. I can't even imagine climbing the steps, holding the, you know, the can of oil, let alone, you know, be in some sort of position to have to save someone.
I don't know if I could either. Patricia Major is the author of Ladies of the Lights, Michigan Women in the U.S. Lighthouse Service. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for taking some time with us.
Thank you.
Next up, the ways the pandemic changed us.
When you got to think long and hard about going to get your groceries and only want to go once a week and make sure you get everything else, that's a kind of intentional living that probably I had not been doing.
Two of our favorite writers, Des Cooper and Keith Taylor, drop in to talk about things that we learned and the watermarks we use for a year of COVID. We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've spent the past couple of weeks marking the various ways that major changes have rolled into our lives with the pandemic, whether in education, our workplaces, or Michigan's economy. We wanted to wrap up this somber one-year anniversary with something a little bit more introspective, how things have changed for us on an individual level. Obviously, that's a lot harder to pin down, since the pandemic has meant something different to everyone. But undoubtedly, it's forced us to all look at the whole of our lives and think about what can change. To help us get our arms around something that's at the same time granular and universal, we're calling up two people who help us with that sort of thing here on Stateside regularly. Desiree Cooper is a writer from Detroit, and Keith Taylor is a writer and lecturer emeritus with the University of Michigan. Des, Keith, welcome back. It is so nice to be with you.
Good to be back. Good to still be here.
That's right. And to hear you, April, at the end of all this. That helps, too.
Can I ask both of you how you've been weathering the pandemic? Des, can you bring us up to date? I know you are out of state looking after your mom right now.
Yeah, and in some ways I've been on lockdown for almost 5 years now, taking care of my senior parents. My dad passed away late last year. My mom's still with us.
Yeah, so sorry to hear about your father.
Oh, I appreciate that. It was not a COVID related death, but of course the pandemic affected everything from how we were able to send him off to what kind of care he had access to in the end. And even his death certificate came months late because there was so much demand, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, you know, oh my goodness, it just feels like how will we ever be the same people we were in 2019?
I guess that's just it. I don't know if we will. Keith, how are things going with you?
Oh, I feel as if, I've had it so easy. But of course, when I start looking back, it's not. I mean, we all have our list of agonies and difficulties. I've been pretty good. I've gone out grocery shopping. I've gone to the pharmacy, always trying to be as careful as I could. I only took one trip. A very good friend had a child die by suicide. So I went to be with him for a while. Another friend who lives over in HUD housing in Ypsilanti, you know, I've just felt the need to get him out. So I talked to him a little more on the phone than I usually have. I get him out for a walk in the parks now and then. But otherwise, I've pretty much been here in my study where I would have been spending most of my time anyway. So it's changed things. How things will change in the future, I have no idea.
It feels like a significant part of this story is that magnification that you both kind of touched on in different ways about how the difficulties of life just have been have become a magnitude different because of this pandemic. And the fact that both of you are so intentional in your use of language, I feel like you've probably thought about this at least a little bit. Would you say, I mean, is that the hardest part about what we're going through, is just the extra intensity on top of everything else right now? Keith, what do you think of that?
You know, the extra intensity on top of everything else, there's a phrase. We can chisel it in stone, April. I think that's it. Life is intense now. And some of my positive responses have been intense, more so than perhaps they might have been otherwise. But boy, you know, you got to think long and hard about going to get your groceries and only want to go once a week and make sure you get everything else. That's a kind of intentional living that probably I had not been doing in 2019.
Is that intensity something that you've had to find words for during, I guess, your extended lockdown, or is that something that you've had to figure out how to communicate?
You know, I remember telling a friend recently, has life been this hard for everyone all this time? And we just didn't realize it. I mean, now that a lot of other distractions are gone and we are, as you say, April, more intent on connection, like you have to work at it. I feel like the woman who reads the sick and shut-in list at the Baptist services every Sunday. I mean, the list of people that I'm trying to keep track of and checking on, the number of people who've lost loved ones, who've suffered other kinds of sort of quote-unquote normal everyday losses, the people who are aging in place. And I feel like all of those are with me all day. And I feel like I just can't even balance. I mean, the stripped down life has suddenly flared up in such a big blazing way. I just cannot. It's very difficult to cope.
Yeah.
In my mind.
Where have you been looking for joy?
Well, I don't want to be a braggart, but sunshine and good weather goes a long way. And having left Michigan, especially in the winters, and to move to the Atlantic coast of Virginia has been a godsend for me. I don't know how I would have managed without those long walks that were daunting for me in the cold, but I can do those very well now. And I will say grandchildren, you know, are the noisiest, most disruptive, most chaotic joys in my life. And I feel like sometimes where things have been stripped down to its Zen simplicity, that both children and the aged have taught me so much more about the present than I think I would have learned otherwise.
Is there something that comes to mind that you've picked up that you think you'll be carrying with you for a long time after this?
Yeah, I'm going to call it American entitlement, that you have control enough to make everything okay. Yeah. And I've been stripped of that. And that's a heavy thing because it makes you a control freak and it makes you constantly at the behest of the normal waves of things that happen in life. And so I'll just say now that while I do have expectations, but I am not invested in them in the way that I used to be. And I have been able to look around. I mean, fortunately, I'm 61 and I can say, well, you know what? It's been a pretty good run. So everything else is gravy. Not that I'm thinking about going anywhere anytime soon, but I'm also locked down in place with my 33-year-old son, who hasn't really had a chance to launch and have his experiences in life. And so together we've been trying to figure out what is the most precious. I mean, I hear him playing the guitar and I just think it's the most beautiful sound in the world. And I remember a time when I'd say, shut that noise up, I can't stand it. and he takes the cardboard boxes that I'm saving and he says, Mom, are we still saving this for the apocalypse? You know, he sees me now as that Depression era baby that we used to talk about in past generations that now I've been changed by, you know, what I think I should save, how I should conserve, how I should spend time, what is family, and what brings you joy, simple joys.
Mm. Keith, how about you? Are there things that are lightening up the days a bit that you maybe didn't expect?
Well, I've often said this about other things, even before the pandemic, but I am so happy and thankful that I have an art in my life, that I can always turn to that when many people don't have something they can turn to. But these, you know, these books are here, my own feeble attempts to get words on paper, that's just a real joy. I have to echo D2 on the family thing. My daughter was in graduate school at Wayne State when all this started. She was living down in the Cass Corridor there, and her apartment building had a major fire 3 months before she graduated. So she came home, because they were doing, and of course everything went online 2 weeks later. So she came home for 3 months, and my wife would be working downstairs in the study. My daughter Faith would be working at the kitchen table, and I'd be up here trying to work in my study. And you know what? It was great. Now, she's 30, and we knew she wasn't going to stay, but it was certainly wonderful having her here. And I don't think she hated it either, so that felt good.
Now, Keith just told us that he has been able to read and to get some work done. Des, how's it going with you? Have you been able to read?
Not really. I mean, I read at it, but often I'm reading the same thing over. I don't remember what I've read. I'm reading a book now. I got to 15 pages before I'd be done, and I put it down. I'm not going to pick it back up. Mm-hmm. I'm a mess. I say my brain is now like a steel sieve. You know, yeah. It retains nothing, and my concentration is zero. I do still try to write and try to be productive, but again, I go back to those expectations. You know, if a blooming flower pulls me outside in the middle of writing something, I'm going outside. If I decide I'm going to make myself the most fantastic carb-heavy meal I can make, that's what I'm going to do. You know, if my mother needs to be entertained because nobody else is around, I'm going to play with dolls with my mom. So I have a disastrous lack of focus at this point. I'm depressed. I'm definitely depressed. Mm-hmm. And so I have to work every day on, you know, you just have to be, and that has to be enough. And I think even now that there might be some light at the end of the tunnel, even though we don't even really know what that looks like, what is being and how is that going to look? I walk this same path almost all the time. And in this really bushy tree, there's one little branch that sticks up that has no leaves on it. It's like somebody forgot to give it a haircut, and it's just a cowlick sticking up. And on that cowlick, there's one bird singing at me every time I go by. One bird sitting on this cowlick in this bushy tree. And I posted this morning, it might be too late. This might be who I am at the end of, you know, the pandemic, where I'm sitting apart and above on this one little cowlick, watching everything else growing around me and kind of screaming at it from afar. Mm. I mean, I'm not so sure how interactive I'm going to feel with the world. You know, you kind of get into this hermit space. I walk, and now I'm wondering, like, do I even want other people in that space to bring in their worries into a space of peace? Like, I want the beach to be empty when I go. I want the parks to be empty when I go. Is that weird?
No, it's not. And I mean, I wonder how much of this has to do with the demands of caregiving in addition to, you know, the habit of the pandemic. But I wonder, for people who are juggling multiple things in this way, Des, I wonder if it's even useful to separate it out in that way, or if it's just the time that is right now.
Right. And whether it's more of a phase, you know, after time, I mean, honestly, we have all become uneasy with humans.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's almost like we have to reacclimate to being in community.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling that kind of acutely. Like, part of me doesn't want to hear people blabbering all the time. Where before I used to enjoy that, you know, a lot, the chatter, the conversation, the noise, the busy restaurants, the blah, blah, blah. And now I just like, I just want to be apart a lot. So it's like the very thing that's got me sad is the very thing that I'm now fitted for. It's kind of interesting.
Keith, you told us at the end of 2020 that you really missed poetry readings in person.
Yeah.
And, you know, Des was just talking about the wish for community. Is that something that's still on your mind?
It is. It is. I miss the, Des, I told April then, I've been to so many, I've been to thousands of readings, and I thought I was sick of them. But I found that, you know, not being able to do that and sit with five people and listen to something that might not even be very good, maybe that was my strongest sense of a community and being part of a community. But I do miss it, and I don't know when that's going to start again. Most people, I think most of my friends, are comfortable doing these Zoom readings. Not that I'm uncomfortable doing them, but they don't feel satisfying either as a presenting author or as an audience member. They feel a little too confident. Look, I'm here in my study. Look at my books. I'm going to read you my poems. Whereas standing in front of a small audience in an auditorium or a bookshop sort of makes you feel more vulnerable. And I think that's usually better for the work you're communicating. So I miss that. I will love it if that happens again. But even if we go back to normal, that particular little very boutique-y aspect of our cultural life might be gone.
Keith, you told us earlier that there's a poem that has really stayed with you this past year.
It has.
Would you share it with us?
I'd be happy to. This was in my life before he passed away, and he died last week. One of several writers who died last week, Adam Zagajewski. I'm going to read the poem called Try to Praise the Mutilated World by Adam Zagajewski, one of the major Polish poets of our time. Interestingly enough, and fortuitously, I am told, this is the poem that appeared in The New Yorker the week after 9/11. I actually keep it and present it often when I want to show what different kinds of nature poems can do. This particular version is translated by Claire Cavanaugh, by the way. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of rosé wine? The nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watch the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn, and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world, and the gray feather of a thrush lost, and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns.
Oh my gosh. There's so much in there about embracing what is most difficult to embrace.
Yeah, there's no, you know, self-delusion there at all. It's he sees things but yet still strives to put it in a context that includes the possibilities of joy.
Well, I guess that's where we are right now, is still striving. Keith Taylor, Des Cooper, it's really, really lovely to hear from you both. Thanks for checking in.
Thank you, April.
Thanks for joining us.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.